Hey, you're listening to Unlimited Hangout, a podcast exclusively available on Rockfin.com. I'm your host, Whitney Webb. Here in early November, we are right smack in the middle of U.S. election chaos. However, having recently finished producing a three-part election special, I felt that it was important to do an episode on a persistent and nefarious agenda that will remain of primary importance to the U.S. and also globally, regardless of what takes place on or after the U.S. election. So recently, we have been hearing more and more about the so-called Great Reset, a marketing blitz being orchestrated by the World Economic Forum, and in particular, the forum's founder, Klaus Schwab. Though the term Great Reset may now be quite familiar to many of you, it is important to point out that this marketing campaign largely exists to promote what Schwab has long referred to as the Fourth Industrial Revolution. Schwab and his ideological allies often promote this new quote-unquote revolution and the current Great Reset as fostering the creation of a world that is, quote, sustainable, empowering, and inclusive. However, if anything, this new world that Schwab and others are promoting is only empowering for those who are already deeply nestled within the halls of global power and is merely a way of sustaining the dominance of this global class of elites as the kings of the high-tech neo-feudal system they seek to create. To discuss this and more, I am joined today by one of the most phenomenal researchers and journalists around today, Corey Morningstar. Corey is an independent investigative journalist based in Canada and is also a longtime environmental activist. Her work has focused on major issues such as the global ecological collapse, the nonprofit industrial complex, imperial wars, and the role NGOs play in promoting or sustaining those wars. And the main topic of today's episode, the Fourth Industrial Revolution. Welcome, Corey. Thank you for being here today.
Hi, Whitney. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate being on your podcast.
So to begin, the Fourth Industrial Revolution is described by the World Economic Forum, or WEF, as a, quote, new chapter in human development enabled by technological advances that are, quote, merging the physical, digital, and biological worlds. It is currently being marketed as a way to ensure that the future is more sustainable and collaborative, or so they say, and those, of course, are just two examples of their many buzzwords. However, beneath the sleek marketing, there is a much more sinister side to what Schwab and others are selling. So, Corey, how would you, based on your own research, summarize what the Fourth Industrial Revolution really is, and what is the world that it actually seeks to create?
Well, basically what it is the fusion of man with machine. And so it's basically blurring the boundaries between physical and digital. And so what that is, it's advances of things that you've written about over the past year or two, Alison McDowell, different people, artificial intelligence, robotics, Internet of Things, which is everything connected to the internet. That runs on the foundation of 5G, which you're not hearing anything about because it's been framed and passed aside into like a conspiracy theory corner, so no one looks there. 3D printing, genetic engineering, gene editing, quantum computing, autonomous weapons, automation. There's some technologies right there. When I started, writing, touching upon this when I was writing the first volume of the Greta series in 2019, and I think in one segment, part Act 5, maybe Act 4 or 5, I touched upon it, and then I actually wrote in the series that I would come back to that and sort of expand upon it. But at that time, Whitney, I honestly thought that that was down the road. You know, I thought that was something that would take a lot of effort to get people on board. For one thing, I didn't think there'd be public uptake, and I mean, it was just so depraved and sort of, you know, representative of the sort of depraved ideologies embodied within the minds of these capitalist psychopaths. And I didn't really see these things taking off anytime soon. I didn't think the people, you know, the global populace at large would accept them. So I thought I had lots of time to write about not only, I mean, I wrote about it in the context, the Green New Deal, the global Green New Deals will be basically a Trojan horse for the fourth industrial revolution, which I do believe is the case. That's been changed now to the Great Reset, sort of a rebrand. I'm sort of rambling all over the place here, but yeah, I think that's a good introduction. And again, at the beginning, so when I realized, okay, so this is happening, you know, now we're going back to March, when I realized it was starting to already really, really roll out, I had to quickly start learning what it was. And I started following the work of Alison McDowell, and she was really, really frustrated that no one was comprehending what she was writing about. And I said, Alison, people don't know this stuff like you do. I mean, she's been writing about it for some time, but I mean, blockchain, what's blockchain? I had to like literally stop what I was doing and go learn about blockchain. So with Forrest Palmer, who works with me, our Wrong Kind of Green Collective, we did create a primer that you can find on YouTube for people. So if you're new to this and you're not sure, you know, you're not really sure what blockchain is and artificial intelligence, machine learning, I recommend that you go to that primer. It was, the text is developed by, I believe his name is I can't think of his last name. Anyway, it's excellent. His name is on there. We credit him right at the beginning, and it's a really great learning tool. I'll just stop there for a minute.
Sure. Well, I think that was a really good introduction because, the fourth industrial revolution is something that they want to implement really in every sector of society. So, you know, there are a lot of, it is a very multi-faceted push, I guess you could say, with that seeks to really, well, as they say, revolutionize every aspect of our lives, right? So there are a lot of different tentacles it has. So as you sort of mentioned earlier in March that you were seeing this start to roll out, as both you and I and several others have noted over the course of this year, the COVID-19 crisis has conveniently allowed for a lot of these disruptive technologies that are at the heart of the fourth industrial revolution have allowed them to be foisted upon the public under the guise of COVID-19 response, which is sort of has really allowed them to jump years ahead in rolling out this agenda than they otherwise would have been able to. So in your opinion, what particular agendas related to the fourth industrial revolution do you think have benefited most from what has transpired under the guise of COVID-19 response?
Yeah, I mean, so last year, the World Economic Forum last June actually partnered officially with the United Nations, and they were put at the helm of the Sustainable Development Goals. People have to understand and recognize the Sustainable Development Goals. They're called, people refer to them as SDGs, or the Global Goals. There's 17 of them. And so what they are, those are emerging markets. So they're basically under the guise of, you know, eradicating poverty, health, these things that sound really wonderful and great. It's actually all about emerging markets. So we had last year and leading up to last year, we had a global economy basically on teetering towards collapse. You had Larry Summers, you had everybody saying, you know, we're really, really close to global collapse here. And then you had last year, all of a sudden, last fall, you started seeing trillions injected into the economy. And I was wondering, and for years and years, I've written about the coming financialization of nature, where they actually will assign a monetary value on every living thing that provides, quotation marks here, ecosystem services. So every single thing free in nature will be monetized and given. Basically, we've got payments for ecosystem services. You've got nature being bought, sold, traded on Wall Street. Those with money, the very people and corporations and institutions that have destroyed and plundered the entire planet are now going to own what's left. And that's also referred to as the biosphere economy. So you've got John Volans, who was one of the Extinction Rebellion business signatories to that. And he called, you know, he's actually said, who will be the Bill Gates of ecosystem services, right?
So oh, man.
Yeah, another emerging market. So what you see, you saw a globe, you know, going towards collapse. I've been asking how will they do another bailout? Like, how will they do another bailout? There's no way people will accept it again after 2008. There's no way people are going to watch their, you know, their houses lost, their pensions gone, chaos. How, right? And I kept wondering how, and it kept getting closer and closer and closer, and the global debt was over $250 trillion. And then at the same time, they started campaigning on the, it's called New Deal for Nature, also Voice for the Planet. It's like a twin campaign out of World Economic Forum and World Wildlife Fund. And that's it, right? That's the legislation through United Nations to implement the natural capital protocols. And so all this was edging closer and closer, and I kept thinking, how are they going to get this into place, right? And then they're selling a lot of it with the language pushed by the, you know, the faux left, the liberal left under the Green New Deal. And so I'm watching this happen, and then all of a sudden we saw the pandemic, right? And we know about that scenario through scenario planning, which is done by corporations and institutions all over the world, as you know, Whitney. And so, yeah, basically that happened in March. The day the pandemic was announced, that same day, the World Economic Forum partnered with the World Health Organization. They announced a partnership with the World Health Organization and over 200 of the largest corporations on Earth to form the COVID Business Task Force. So it's just like this tidal wave of stuff happening. And then you had that pandemic, which Klaus Schwab calls a watershed moment. And so, this is their words, not mine, watershed moment. COVID-19 is catalyst. I mean, last year I kept writing, they're resetting the economy. They're resetting the economy. They're rebooting the economy. They want to reboot the economy, right? They need $100 trillion. They're eyeing the pension funds. They need more money. When you monetize nature and replace GDP with natural capital, GDP's basically, that's around $90 trillion a year. And then the value, quote unquote, monetary value of nature, it comes in around $140 trillion a year. So right away, all of a sudden, you create $50 trillion out of thin air. So it's all about markets. It's all about money. It's all about expansion and protection of existing power structures. And then everything you see is window dressing, right? It's all like trying to maintain and maintain existing social license to operate and achieve social license to operate for the Great Reset, which is, again, dressed in words like imagination and build back better.
Right. The marketing angle of this is really amazing to me, because if you look at the people that compose the World Economic Forum, including the background of Klaus Schwab itself, you know, you find some of the most notorious criminal corporations and financial enterprises. You know, you have people like Paul Singer, a U.S. billionaire who's often referred to as one of the most notorious, quote unquote, vulture capitalists. For example, you know, he's part of this, but, you know, they've been able to market it and really using mainly buzzwords or phrases or things like that that seem designed to appeal mainly to people on the left and those that are critics of capitalism. So it's really been amazing how they've been able to hoodwink people. And I think it's very telling that they've been so focused on trying to get the consent of people on the quote unquote left, particularly progressives.
Yeah, I mean, you can see, okay, so one of the key players involved in this, Christiana Figueres, who was the UN secretary, she brought in the Paris Agreement in 2015. Her family goes way back, Costa Rica. You know, her family's held the position of president there, her brother, her dad, her father. Anyway, she's really quite instrumental in a lot of this, including bringing Greta Thunberg to the first Davos in 2019. Why was I even telling you about her? So what did you just say that was leading me to that?
Well, I was talking about how, no worries, so how the World Economic Forum and Klaus Schwab and people like that have been able to sort of cloak the fourth industrial revolution and these words and these phrases that appeal to the appeal mainly to the progressive left.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this woman, Christiana Figueres, so she's works with We Mean Business. She has started, which actually is the key person group behind the Greta Thunberg campaign, which started back in 2018. That was sort of what kicked everything off that. And so she wrote a book. It's called The Future We Choose. It's actually all about the future they choose. So it's just like another sort of storytelling effort to bring people on board. And if you look at that, I mean, it's just incredible. There's even Naomi Klein and Klaus Schwab are the two key endorsers for that book. So there you have Naomi Klein and Klaus Schwab.
Together.
Which Richard Branson, right? We Mean Business, World Resources Institute, which works arm in arm with the Council on Foreign Relations. I mean, it's really, really powerful, the nonprofit industrial complex and academia and science, right? It's all funded by the same foundations, the same corporations. And I mean, that is, they've actually bought it all. They own it all. They control it all. Right. So independent journalism is really under attack and getting more and more difficult more and more important and more important to protect.
Right. Well, I think it's interesting then that a lot of the people that have been the biggest attack dogs are really funding those attacks on independent media have been a lot of the same billionaires, particularly Silicon Valley billionaires that stand to benefit most from the fourth industrial revolution and things like that being implemented, to the greatest extent possible. And so we have, a lot of people like Pierre Omidyar, who not only funds Naomi Klein, right, at The Intercept, but also a lot of these quote-unquote fact-checking organizations and things like that, and these pushes to essentially regulate independent media or social media censorship and things like that. I think it's no coincidence we have that going on. And also the World Economic Forum, through the Great Reset specifically, has partnered with several mainstream media organizations, including one in the U.S. called The Conversation, where they, the World Economic Forum will publish an article, one of their articles, and The Conversation will run it at the same time. And, it looks like it's coming from the journalists at The Conversation, and then you have to get to the bottom to find out that it was sponsored by the World Economic Forum and things like that, right? So, definitely there is a huge effort to censor dissenting voices in media and promote the ones that are, willingly promoting this agenda for whatever reason. So definitely a good point.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like even Imperial College works, right? They're in partnership with the World Economic Forum and the Center for the Fourth Industrial Revolution. And even last January, when a lot of this stuff really, really started pushing forward, like sort of, launching into the public sphere. They talk about, they had big meetings there about a vaccine revolution, how to create a vaccine revolution, because more and more people, including frontline workers, doctors, nurses, are not trusting vaccines. So they even, I found even big, great big things on the wall showing how many people still trust in vaccines versus how many people don't trust in vaccines, right? So this was a really huge problem. And so, yeah, there's lots of documentation about a vaccine revolution and how to create one. That was last November. And now what do we see? Now we see, oh, what a surprise, great big vaccine. Again, sustainable development goal, I believe it's number 3, is health. If you look at that right now, that's where all the money is being injected into number 3 because of the vaccine market, right? So, yeah, mm-hmm. This stuff's all tied in together, all interwoven. All these, big supposedly green NGOs, Greenpeace helped create We Mean Business, right? They helped create that organization, which represents, I think it's 24 million in market cap, 24 trillion. So they're all woven in together, right? Avaaz, Purpose, Greenpeace, 350.org, like all the big ones. World Wildlife Fund, again, one of the worst guilty of complicit in murder, rape, torture of Indigenous peoples. It's all being done under the guise of protection and saving the planet. Like, it's actually horrific.
Well, it's definitely horrific, that's for sure. But on a related point, one thing I have always found really interesting about the push for the Fourth Industrial Revolution coming from people like Klaus Schwab and the World Economic Forum is that they describe it not as a prediction of what the future may look like, but as a call to action. And they essentially say that this is something we have to create and we have to implement. And I think that's really telling, not just because of the marketing ploy, but because they feel, in my opinion, that this is really the only way they can continue to sustain the existing power structures, right? Which is, I think, what they really mean when they use the words sustainable in relation to the Fourth Industrial Revolution and things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, if you go back again to Davos that last December when they're really launching this stuff into the public sphere, and you hear, you know, Greta Thunberg for the World Economic Forum, we want you to panic. The house is burning. The house is burning. And then you go back and we find that sort of campaign being created by the climate mobilization. Again, all this stuff is interwoven, intermixed, same people, same organizations, all funded by millions and billions of dollars. And so it's their house on fire, right? Like, yeah, the ecological issues, everything is real. I mean, you know, we're destroying the ecosystems we depend on for all life. That's real, but they don't care about that. Okay, so they're
responsible for a lot of that, right?
So that's so frustrating now to see people supporting this and promoting it. It's like, okay, these are the people and institutions that have just destroyed the whole fucking planet. They are not going to be the ones to save it, right? We have to tear down these institutions and these power structures. You cannot save the planet in the same system that destroyed it. And so that part is really, really frustrating, but they're so great at storytelling and they have so many resources and they just basically employ their armies of NGO and academia and science. And it's just like a complete, hijacking of the collective psyche, right? Like, it's storytelling, it's social engineering, it's conditioning. That's such a huge aspect of all of this. Like, even with the COVID-19, the pandemic, everyone thinking all of a sudden these people care about our health. We all have Teflon in our bodies because our governments have allowed that to happen, right? The corporations mm-hmm. that run governments have done that to us. Our air is polluted, our water is polluted, our environment is poisoned. These people don't give a shit about your health, right? They never have and never will. It's not about that. This is about alienating people, making people terrified to accept their said solutions, you know, all under the guise of protecting biodiversity, protecting the planet, protecting climate. Oh, we have to do this. It's the only way. No, but like you said, Whitney, it's the only way for them to protect their ruling class status, right? They're terrified of becoming like us.
Well, you know, with the whole COVID-19 thing, you know, before they were selling it as the only way to get out of the climate crisis, but now with COVID-19, they can sell a lot of the technologies that sort of underpin the Fourth Industrial Revolution as necessary because of the fear over disease and the fear over the coronavirus and all of this stuff, saying, you know, making people feel like their bodies are inherently flawed or dangerous, that human workers in certain jobs and professions present a danger to people, whereas that wasn't, you know, a common way of thinking before. And so we've seen this push, for example, to sell things that have long underpinned this Fourth Industrial Revolution push, like automation, robots, artificial intelligence. We're being told that this is, you know, now necessary in order to reduce risk in terms of public health and other things. So I think COVID-19 has added like a new level of marketing potential for them. And this is interesting too, because specifically automation robots, artificial intelligence. This obviously leaves little room for many jobs in manufacturing and other sectors that have traditionally been performed by people. So in any other quote-unquote normal world, right, those efforts would generate a lot of pushback from the public. And so, you know, their efforts to sell this under, oh, we have to save the planet and all this stuff before COVID-19 didn't really didn't actually take hold in the collective psyche, I guess you could say, as much as they had hoped before COVID-19. And now with COVID-19, they have a whole new layer that's based around concern about public health, among other things. And I think a key part of this, too, that they're trying to market alongside those technologies are things like smart cities. I personally have seen several media reports over the course of the year saying that even though smart cities would be denser, more densely populated, they're actually better for fighting and preventing future pandemics and all of this stuff. So it's very interesting to see that. And at the same time, we also see smart cities over the past several years being sold along the same lines, like you were pointing out, as more sustainable and inclusive, seemingly designed to appeal to people on the left and those who are critics of capitalism. But as you've pointed out in your work, smart cities are likely to merely lead us into the next phase of capitalism, just one that's more technocratic and arguably, because of that high tech, more pervasive than its predecessors. So if you wouldn't mind expanding a little bit on smart cities in general, why they're crucial to the fourth industrial revolution in the context of automation and all this stuff, and how they are not actually going to solve the problems we're being told they'll solve, in that instead, you know, they're really a blueprint for neo-feudalism.
Okay, so basically smart cities, I mean, for one thing, I just want to mention this because I thought it was really interesting. I was looking a few months ago at an article on smart cities about transit, and they're actually designing smart city buses already where everyone's seated apart from one another. So the future, there's a really great article on Wrong Kind of Green, as well as a blog called Winter Oak, and it's called Klaus Schwab and His Great Fascist Reset. And the author, he's read through all three or four of Klaus Schwab's books, and he's taken out the whole article is almost direct quotes from Klaus Schwab, but it gives you a really fascinating insight into what he sees as our future, right? For instance, people, simple joys in life, such as smelling, picking up a cantaloupe and smelling it and taking in the scent and, you know, the textures, the just that experience in itself, things like that, people won't even touch one. So a lot of what you're saying about this phobia of pandemic germs, that's really gonna help instill what they see coming. So basically smart cities. So here's the thing. It's all going forward under the pretext, oh, this is going to basically save our planet, sustainable planet, right? Before Green New Deal, and then UN came out at the same time with Global Green Deal. So it was going to be global. They call this new global governance, right? New global architecture. It's presented and sold on the pretext it will be clean, right? But when you start going and listening to Deloitte and Touche, every McKinsey, videos, white papers on the fourth industrial revolution, you'll see nothing about nature. You'll see nothing about trees, nothing. It's all about tech and control and people working within this highly controlled digital economy, which they themselves say. I mean, there's one video that actually says who will survive and who will perish. They foresee it as a lot of people are going to suffer. Yeah, a lot of people will suffer tremendously. A lot of people will end up killing themselves. The global south. A lot of the global south will starve. That's all informal economies. They don't give a fuck. They're crushing them, right? So we're moving from bricks and mortar to digital. And if you're not going there, you're goodbye, you're done. So again, smart cities are, everything has to run on 5G. Okay, so that's really, really important to know. So without the 5G infrastructure, there's no fourth industrial revolution, there's no great reset. In 2030, that will turn into 6G. So this is really, really powerful. 5G is 100 times more powerful than 4G. It's the foundation for future autonomous weapons. It's really, really tied in with artificial intelligence and wars, which you already know about and write about. They're looking at around $100 trillion to do all this. They're eyeing the pension funds. And so the thing about this, So it's basically presented as clean. So my third segment of the piece I just did now, I think is going to shock a lot of people, because up until now, people have looked at aviation as one of the major greenhouse gas emission sources, right, on the planet. Like, people have looked at aviation as being really bad for climate and that. Well, what is coming is going to dwarf that. Like, that's going to look like child's play, because what is coming is, we had about 500,000 data centers in 2000, and I think it's 2010 to 2012. Well, now we're up to over 8 million, okay? So the data centers, like, when you hear of things, everyone thinks, oh, the cloud, right? The cloud. It sounds so pure. It sounds like, and a lot of this, it goes back again, framing, language, storytelling. So people think of technology as clean, right? Internet of things, clean. Oh, all this stuff's magically happening. No power, no pollution, no nothing. But that's the furthest thing from the truth. So all the data has to go into data centers. So now they're building hyperscale data centers. And just this year and next year alone, I mean, how quickly they're building them to keep up with this data. And the whole world is going to move digital. So imagine, I mean, you're looking at 15-fold by 2030, which might even be, really, really underestimating it, because this thing is going forward so far. Like, telehealth this year went from 3% to 80% in a couple months, right? So it's all moving online. All that takes massive amounts of energy. And so they cover that. They say, well, we're using all green energy and all renewables and solar and wind. Okay, so what they don't say, again, go to the white papers, what they're actually doing, yes, solar, yes, wind, neither of those are clean or green, but even if they were, all the new energy being created is being sucked in, absorbed into the data centers. So we're not offsetting anything we're doing now with new energy. Like, we're not creating new energy to get rid of coal plants or anything else. We're just creating, it's the Jevons, I think it's called Jevons paradox. We're creating new energy, and where it's being used, consumed, and it's carbon capture storage, right? Where you you burn and you pump it underground, right? And that leads into, what's it called? An enhanced oil recovery. That carbon not only is pumped into the ground, it helps rejuvenate dead oil wells. So now you've got more oil that you can burn, right? And then we'll buy carbon offsets, more nuclear energy. Bill Gates, Zuckerberg, Bezos, they're all co-founders of Breakthrough Energies, Breakthrough Energy Ventures. That's nuclear, carbon capture storage. I mean, it's sold under the veneer of clean and green and beautiful and trees and environment, climate, Greta Thunberg. That in actuality, smart cities are being built on the backs of, we actually don't have enough metals and rare earth metals on this planet to build everything in this depraved architecture. And so they've already now started mining the oceans. I mean, that's happening, just starting now. Mm-hmm. That's another new industry. So think about that. This is all supposed to be to protect biodiversity. Now we're going to mine the oceans. There is so much dependent on the earth. That's the life on earth is so interwoven with the life in the ocean. Like, even the plankton, it's so incredibly dangerous to be mining oceans and so incredibly stupid and short-sighted. But that's what they're doing, right? Because it's not about the planet. It's not about people's health. It's not about protecting biodiversity. It's about money. It's about power. It's about protecting the very system that's destroying the planet.
Well, I think there is an element of nature to what they're, to what motivates them, but I think it's very different than how people like you and I would look at it. I think these people, their ideology is rooted in an ideology that's been around for a really long time, really, about the need of man, of mankind to dominate nature, viewing nature as something not to be lived in harmony with, but as something to be controlled and dominated. And if you look back at, like, the colonial period, you know, the Europeans in the Americas, you know, they described nature as it was there, the forest and also the indigenous people as savage, something to be civilized and things like that. And so I think this is really the extreme, you know, that taken to its extreme logical conclusion is a lot of what we're seeing now. So like smart cities, for example, even though they're marketed under this, you know, veneer of, oh, we're helping to save nature by living in them, it would just separate the people that live in those cities from nature to a huge degree, but they're being marketed or being made to appeal subconsciously to people's desire to be in nature, or to help nature, or to save nature, and all of this stuff is, I think it's all playing into part of that, but the end goal, I think, is steeped in the same ideology that's been very pervasive and around for centuries that views nature as something to be defeated and as an enemy, right? And so that's why I think this effort to merge humanity with machines, right, is sort of born out of that, and I think that's why a lot of these people that are driving this agenda, you know, are transhumanists, because they feel that humanity as a, you know, a human being, as a part of nature, as a natural being, that is wrong, that, you know, humans need to dominate nature. And so the pinnacle of human evolution is not for humans to live in complete harmony with nature or whatever. It's instead for them to merge with machines and things like that, because that's what the transhumanists think, that the pinnacle of evolution is the merging of humans with machines, which is the ultimate removal of humanity from nature, right? So I think, you know, they try to appeal to the inner desire and subconscious desire in people to be more connected with nature, because a lot of social ills, for example, that we experience, or depression that people experience, has to do with the disconnect from nature that exists in our society as it is today. And obviously the fourth industrial revolution would just exacerbate that to a huge degree.
Yeah. I mean, just even a few months ago when, I mean, right now at this moment, climate change has taken a bit of a back burner. Like, the whole discussion around that is a selling point for everything, that all their architecture that they want to propel forward. But here and there, when I see it, you know, sort of some articles on it, it'll say, you know, stuff about bike lanes. And, you know, of course everyone wants bike lanes and all that, and all that's great, but that's not what this is about. Right. So it's always repackaging things that are, you know, to, you know, basically seduce people. It's like, right, you know, the taste of what they would like to see and what everyone would like to see. And it sounds great. Right. But you don't talk about stuff.
Well, I think it's sort of what you allude to in your new series about social media. You know, how they framed originally social media as, oh, it's going to keep you more connected and make you more social. But instead, it's, as you point out, really destroyed the social. And that destruction was calculated. That was the original plan. But it was marketed originally as something that would make us more social, right? And so a lot of the fourth industrial revolution things are being sold under a similar guise. But obviously, if you see where things are really going, it's not going to make things, it's not going to create an environmentally sustainable system. People will not be happier, right? And all of this stuff. And it's the calculated destruction of just, you know, major aspects of what has held together human society for centuries, right? So that seems to be a common theme here in terms of how they market it. They say it's going to create more of something or foster more connection with something that people want, whereas in reality that it will have the opposite effect, and they're very well aware of this. So with that being said, so your new series is called It's Not a Social Dilemma, It's the Calculated Destruction of the Social, and that focuses on the role of social media companies and related entities, including the World Economic Forum, in engaging in what you argue is the calculated destruction of normal human social interaction, which of course is an obstacle to a lot of things related to the Fourth Industrial Revolution and its vision of impersonal automation and social connection existing chiefly via technological means instead of, you know, how it's always normally been done. So I wanted you to expand a little bit on those ideas, and if you wouldn't mind also focusing on what you touch on in the second part of your series about how these social media companies, namely Facebook, are using their technology and capital to engage in what you refer to as digital colonialism.
Okay, so that the documentary right now that's really, have you seen it? The one on Netflix, The Social Dilemma?
I don't have Netflix, so okay. No.
So on Netflix, this documentary came out, and it was like right off the bat, you know, you could just see media was really pushing it. All of a sudden, you know, one of those things, you're not even on Netflix, but somehow you already know about it. One of those things, because it's just creeping in to, you know, on the right side of Twitter here and there, like they just push it into your psyche, whether you want to see it or not. So anyway, I saw this film sort of going big, so I watched it. I don't have it, but I have a password I can use someone else's. So anyway, I watched it, and, you know, I'm watching it, and I'm like, yeah, you know, I guess, yeah, that's good. Like, this is all, yeah, I agree with this, and this part's good. And then I could see the parts that were not good on, like, people that have seen the film. I don't want to go through all the film, but people already know what's in the film, how they frame it. Like, you know, even all voting is the be all and end all. Like, meanwhile, voting in the U.S., like, whatever. Anyway.
yeah, I mean, that's how I feel.
Yeah, I could see, I don't even know exactly what it was in the film that sort of piqued my interest, but it was something. I can't tell you now exactly what it was, but when I went back to the computer, I started sort of looking at the main people that were in the movie, and especially the main character, Tristan Harris. And right away, within no time, I started seeing he was involved with, he had this thing called Center for Humane Technology, and he's from Google, right? And then I started seeing, oh, Center for Humane Technology, looking there, looking at the funders, looking at the co-founders. And right away, one of the co-founders is part of the Artificial Intelligence Committee for the World Economic Forum Fourth Industrial Revolution Center. So I started seeing already all these overlapping ties. And then I just sort of dove into that. I knew that was something. And, you know, it's just another thing. It's brought to you basically to obtain that, like, okay, so they recognized quite long ago that there would be societal backlash to all this coming technology, because, as you know, they understand it is being very, very dangerous, right? In their own words, like I said, who will survive, who will perish? So they knew that they needed to get people on board with this. Well, how do you do that? You do that through what they call civil society, which isn't civil society, but it's NGOs. So you need academia on board, you need NGOs on board, you need your media on board. So right away, they've already started this a couple years ago, funding, putting huge amounts of funding into these groups. So the Center for Humane Technology, the co-founders came from Google, right? They're all like multi-billionaires from creating their different apps, whatever. And then that became, you know, Arianna Huffington, right? Huffington Post.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so billionaire, I think in 2000, early, maybe 2014, she's on the cover of Forbes, one of the most powerful women in the world. So all of a sudden, Tristan Harris is in a partnership with Thrive, with Arianna Huffington's Thrive Global, which is all about behavioral change, right? And again, in ushering in this Fourth Industrial Revolution workforce, they need workers for the coding. And so if you look at that, well, who funded, who was funding Thrive Global? It's a venture It's presented more like a media outlet that's actually venture capital. And so who funded that? Oh, Mark Benioff, Salesforce.
Oh, from Salesforce.
Yeah, and mm-hmm. He's a member of trustees on the World Economic Forum mm-hmm. and the inaugural chair of the Center for the Fourth Industrial Revolution. So he's involved in that. Funding this Thrive Global. So anyway, it changes. All of a sudden, Thrive Global adopts what it used to be called Time Well Spent, Center for Humane Technology. And then they changed it from Time Well Spent to Center for Humane Technology. And then Time Well Spent became Time Well Spent Thrive Global. Right? And so Tristan Harris and Mark Benioff have a close relationship. Again, all these people, Wired Magazine, the co-founder of Wired Magazine is the leading author of the 2010 Scenario Planning Report Lockstep for the Rockefeller Foundation. These people are all interwoven, all like working together to push this revolution forward. So that basically goes through. Part one is about why that film exists, why it's okay, I don't want to say why it exists or why it's created, because I'm not the director of the film and I don't know what his intentions were. And they may very well be very different from what, you know, ultimately what it is being used for. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't want to put words into his mouth. I haven't looked that closely at the director of the film, but basically I'm just saying here's what it serves. And so it serves to obtain social license. It serves to say, okay, Whitney, you know what? It's scary going forward. There are problems with artificial intelligence, but don't worry. We're just as concerned with you as you are, and we're going to make sure all those things are taken care of, right? So it's basically assurance. Right, and conditioning people into the idea that people have their back, that there's NGOs and organizations that are very concerned about this, just like Greenpeace, right? You don't really have to do anything. Go back to your show, go back to whatever you were doing, because we've got you. And so it's just,
right.
Oh, and so then part two of the series is about, and it's sort of like, okay, well, what does this film not tell us? It's telling us a lot of stuff most of us already knew. So even though it's, you know, good refresher, you know, come on, we knew all this stuff anyway. Okay, what they don't tell you is what's happening right now. So cable, underwater sea cable, which is the length is basically the entire circumference of the earth, is being put around Africa right now. So I call it the enclosure of Africa, because that's what they're doing, and not just Facebook. The populations all over the world, like in the G20 states, are on the decline big time. The only populations that are actually set to grow are Africa and South Asia. So all eyes, not just suddenly now, for many years now, are on Africa. Even NGO headquarters have moved to Africa. That's the next big thing, right? The markets here are saturated. Everyone's in debt. There's nowhere to go. The markets are, that's what this is all about, new markets. So it's off to Africa to digital enslavement under the guise of empowerment, right? I mean, there's so many places in the world at this point. This is the so they call this the fourth industrial revolution. So we're at the fourth industrial revolution, and look at all the people that still have no access to clean drinking water, no access to clean sanitation. And we're going to bring them internet? That's the main thing they need? Come on. Right? And so it's bullshit. It's all about data now. Data is the new oil. It's a new class asset, and that's where everybody's at, and that's the new game in town.
That was a really good point you just brought up about how these they don't really care about clean drinking water or like basic needs, right? But you have people promoting connectivity, internet access for those people, or like Mark Zuckerberg behind that, or Elon Musk, people like that doing those particular initiatives among others. And then on the other side of that, you have people like Bill Gates trying to give these same populations, you know, access to immunizations and vaccines, but not being focused on philanthropy that would improve, you know, things like drinking water or shelter, you know, or other basic human needs. And of course, if you look at Bill Gates' philanthropy, like the Gavi Vaccine Alliance, they say on their website that it's about improving the health of vaccine markets, not the people that they're vaccinating, not their health, right? The health of the market, right? Which I think is really telling about the mindset of these people, but it's also a testament to just how successful they've been in their marketing ploys and just the extreme consolidation, you know, through their massive wealth that they've been able to, you know, how much they've been able to consolidate control over the media and by extension, the collective psyche, and really convince people that despite their horrendous track records, you know, this is true for Bill Gates and the World Economic Forum and any of these people, that they have our best interests in heart when everything they've done up to now points in the complete opposite direction. So, you know, it's just really telling. And so really quick, just to end, I wanted to touch on some issues that I think are very related to what we've been discussing, particularly the push for universal basic income, or UBI, and the Green New Deal, which you touched on a little bit earlier. So before COVID-19, during specifically in U.S. politics during the last Democratic primary, there was this deliberate insertion of those policies like UBI and the Green New Deal into the mainstream political lexicon, and then subsequent efforts to really popularize those policies among progressives in particular in the United States. And of course, you know, particularly the idea of a UBI, those are actually conveniently for the World Economic Forum and their allies, cornerstones of the Fourth Industrial Revolution that are ardently supported by the same predatory billionaires that progressives would normally distrust and view as their antagonists. And of course, UBI, that whole concept goes back to like what the godfather of neoliberalism, Milton Friedman himself, not exactly a progressive, right? So it's just kind of interesting to see how, you know, those things have been promoted under a similar guise. But I was interested in getting your thoughts on the role that UBI specifically, but also you can discuss the Green New Deal a little more if you want, as it plays into this. But, you know, how those are actually crucial to what they want to do with the Fourth Industrial Revolution, and how this differs from the ways it has been publicly marketed.
Okay, so right after the announcement of the World Economic Forum WHO partnership for the COVID-19 Business Task Force, announced the same day as the pandemic in March, about 15 days later, they announced, they unveiled a global, what's it called, the global, it's through the United Nations, the Global Education Fund, which is all actually universal online learning for the whole world. And so in that space, Facebook, Google, MasterCard, again, like all, you know, all the big players all together, people should check that out. And so the whole goal to get the whole, you know, a lot of this is not only contraction of economies, like crushing out the informal economies, crushing out, you know, artisans, small business, crushing all that out, you know, as Amazon and everybody else, you know, doubles, triples their profits and business. But it's about moving everyone towards this universal education and universal UBI. And what people don't understand about UBI, like you said, Whitney, it's pushed forward by who? The billionaires, Branson, Zuckerberg, Jack Dorsey, right? Like all the billionaires want to give you UBI, right? You know, let's see Branson and Zuckerberg and Gates live on $1,000 a month. I'd love to see it. What they don't understand about that is what's coming by 2030, they want to have all the world on universal healthcare, all privatized healthcare. So it sounds good. Oh, an extra $1,000 a month, right? Who can't use it? We're all trapped in this shit system. So unfortunately, money's a part of that right now, at the present. So sounds great. But what they don't tell you is that the reason they want to do it and are planning to do it is because it will save them a fortune in other services, for instance, healthcare, and all the things benefits that come along with that for people, you know, dental, health. Every country has different types of packages for assistance programs and that type of thing. For instance, in Ontario, we have Indigenous communities way, way, way up north. And so when they need health care, or for instance, if one of the children, you know, to be educated, they'll have to leave their communities and go to a city, university, or college, that transportation will be provided. And if it wasn't, there's no way people could afford to pay for it, right? A $600 flight one way type of thing. All that stuff kiss it goodbye. All gone under UBI. I mean, it won't happen at exactly the same time. First, you'll get your checks and it will feel really good, right? Just like this year in Canada, everyone has their money because they know basically UBI is this. We can give UBI or the people will revolt, right? So it's a choice between a whole populace revolting or giving them a pittance, which is what UBI is. It's enough so you won't starve to death, but just enough, right? And not only that, once you have to start paying for little things that before were covered in other ways through health, education, different programs, all that will disappear. You'll be on your own. And that's where blockchain comes in, right? Again, connected to working on the 5G networks. So blockchain creates coercion, right? Without the physical force. So basically you need your UBI. Well, through blockchain, smart contracts, you will have to fulfill, there's no human oversight. So you'll have to fulfill your end of the smart contract to get that check, that money you need to feed your children, right? And so it's another element of how to coerce a population. You want your check, where's your digital wallet? Oh, you don't have one? Well, you've got to sign up. No, you don't have a choice. If you don't have a digital wallet, you don't get it, right? So much of this is about coercion as well.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because what we're seeing some of the companies we've been talking about today and that you mentioned pretty recently, like MasterCard, for example, you know, they have this thing that they are creating and largely trying to implement in developing countries called Trust Stamp, where they're trying to sort of link people's financial activity and their identity cards to vaccine records, sort of as a way to, oh, you want to continue your participation in the economy? Well, you'll have to get the vaccine, and who knows what they could tack onto there in the future, right? Oh, you have to do this or that in order to continue to participate in the financial system that is, you know, all digital now. And things like that. So it's definitely something that is obviously a major factor in this for the people planning all of this out. But I think it gets overlooked very often by people that are, you know, currently, for example, in the U.S. promoting UBI, saying that it's necessary and people in the U.S. need it in order to sort of weather the COVID-19 crisis and all of that. But ultimately what UBI does, I think, is basically say, you know, it basically maintains the system as it is, right? By giving people a pittance so they can continue to survive in what is ultimately a predatory system that doesn't benefit them by sort of, you know, giving them something that allows them to sort of make it a little bit, but as you pointed out, just barely, and really nothing else beyond that, as opposed to investing instead in the creation of systems that would benefit them and actually be more equitable. But instead, you know, UBI is sort of, you know, being sold as the, you know, the panacea to a lot of these issues.
Yeah, I mean, all of this stuff, ultimately, it's presented. What we see, everything's put out. They're not interested in anything other than market solutions. So there's so many solutions, and so much of our problems could be solved, you know, even locally in our own communities. But those are never looked at unless everything's at scale, right? Market solutions. And if it's not in their best interest, they don't do it. So everything has to be looked at through that lens. You know, this isn't for the best interests of the people. It's always to serve their interests.
right?
At our expense, right? At the living world's expense.
Well, as we talked about today, it's not just our expense, right? It's also the planet, right? You know, it's also at the expense of nature. The same predators, I guess you could say, that have upended the natural world, you know, are saying they're going to save it. If we go into these systems and implement these systems that are going to undermine that in human society and interaction as a whole. So really, you know, it's to me, the Great Reset and all of this just seems like a massive way to try and hoodwink people to get them to consent to a system that is totally not in their benefit and would totally aggravate the existing problems to a huge degree, entrench them, and make them almost impossible to really fix at any time in the future because of the extreme involvement of technology, its use, and its use, its potential use for surveillance and control at the end of the day.
Yeah, like I think if we don't stop this, we're going to have a really, really difficult time later on trying to get out of it.
Right. So I think that, you know, the point we're at now, you know, it's really hard to do what a lot of people in the U.S. and in other, you know, other places have, you know, the default response to a lot of these issues in the past, you know, was to kick the can down the road. But as we're, you know, in the middle of what they're saying is this catalyst for the Great Reset and we're moving into this, you know, we can't really do that anymore, because if we try to kick the can down the road anymore and don't do anything to actively push back against what they're trying to do here, you know, then we will get the fourth industrial revolution, because, you know, as we mentioned earlier, this is something they're actively trying to create. You know, the Great Reset, the fourth industrial revolution, is not something that they're passively allowing to happen. It's something they're actively creating. It's a call to action, right? As they say, or as they have said for the past several years. So, you know, it definitely, we definitely are at the point where, you know, it's time to make the choice and do something about it, or resign yourself to this, you know, Orwellian hellscape that will not save nature, as they are trying to tell you, but actually make our environmental problems that are existentially bad right now even worse. So with that being said, Corey, I want to thank you so much for being here today and talking about a lot of these issues. But especially because of all the crazy stuff going on right now, including, you know, for a lot of my listeners in the U.S., the crazy stuff going on in and around the U.S. election, you know, a lot of people aren't paying attention necessarily to these issues, but I definitely think they should, because I said at the beginning of the broadcast, you know, this is something that's going to remain, not just in the U.S., but, in you know, for countries around the world, regardless of what goes on in the U.S. election or really any other sort of electoral politics situation. In any country, this is a global agenda with a lot of money and a lot of power behind it. And if we are not educated about what it is and not paying attention to what you know, they're doing, we're not really going to be able to stop it. So with that being said, thanks again for being here. And thank you to you all for listening to this episode of Unlimited Hangout. Catch you all next time.